It is a great pleasure to have Ben Brown from Copenhagen. He is a world-leading expert on quantum error correction. He will tell us about conservation laws and quantum error correction. So please.
Okay, thanks, Benny. Thanks for the introduction. So this talk is about, as Benny said, conservation laws and quantum error correction. So what this is really about is, so quantum error correction is all about how you put a lot of sort of quite noisy qubits together in such a way that they can protect a small amount of logical information that we can then go on to do real quantum computing with. And to make that work, we have to make these things called quantum error correcting codes. And those quantum error correcting codes, we measure stabilizer degrees of freedom. We use that information to try and discover what errors the system's experienced. But to do that, there was one other step that I didn't quite explain there, where we need a decoding algorithm. A decoding algorithm takes that syndrome information and works out what has gotten wrong with it. And that's quite an important part of the error correcting code itself. That's just a classical algorithm that runs on a classical computer, and it's got to be fast and it's got to be good at decoding things. And this talk is a lot about decoding algorithms. But more generally, what I want to talk about is what structure do quantum error correcting codes have that allow us to run decoding algorithms, and specifically a particularly successful kind of decoder is called a minimum weight perfect matching decoder. And I'm going to talk about that and how that works and how to generalize that. And I've got quite a lot of papers about that now with a lot of co-authors you can kind of see around here. What we found is we've improved several kinds of decoders. And what I really want to do, or where I want to get to with this whole program, is I want to know how to, I want to make a general minimum weight matching decoder that can work for any kind of code. I don't know if it's possible. I don't know why it's not possible. But so far, with the examples I have, good things have happened. And I'm working through it. So this work all kind of began in a way when I did a project with Dominic Williamson. We looked at some complicated fracton models, which are models of interest to people working in condensed matter physics, for reasons to do with classifying topological order. That's quite a wacky model, but it kind of showed us this way of generalizing decoding. So I'm going to talk about that, but at the end, so this talk isn't chronological. That's the main thing. So as well as that, within all this work, we also discovered good decoders for decoding bias noise and good codes for decoding bias noise. And this came from looking at all of the structure of different kinds of quantum error correcting codes and the decoders that decode them as well. So we've written a couple of papers on that with my collaborators at Sydney. I've looked at where I want to go with this is maybe look at some even more complicated codes like Haas qubit code, and I haven't succeeded at that yet. But we've made some progress looking at classical codes, and that's some work I did with Georgia. And my most recent work I did with Caviar on the color code. Everybody likes color codes, and it's kind of neat, and there's some nice pictures. So I'm going to talk about that the most. And also, funnily enough, in this whole program of symmetries, before I did the first work with Dom, I actually did some work on symmetries with Naomi. I just didn't know it at that point when we were trying to decode correlated noise. And I'll try and mention a little bit about how that fits in as well. Okay, so the main idea I'm going to tell you about in about the first four slides. Okay, so I'll stop for questions after about slide four or slide five. Because if everybody understands that idea, you get the whole message of the paper and it's good. And all I'm going to do is keep applying that idea throughout the talk. So here's a quantum error correcting code. It's called the toric code. You put the qubits on the edges of a square lattice. And those are physical qubits that can experience some errors. But that's okay, because we're going to detect those errors and protect a small amount of encoded information in what we call the code subspace. And we specify that code subspace with what's called the stabilizer group. The stabilizer group is a group of commuting Pauli operators, and that group doesn't contain a negative identity. The code space is the common plus one eigenspace of all of those stabilizers. So the toric code has two types of stabilizers that we tend to call star operators, which are the product of Pauli X terms around all of the edges that touch a vertex. And we have Plaquette operators, which are the product of Pauli Z on all of the edges that wrap around a face of this square lattice. Okay, so that's a convenient language to describe a code. So a code also has logical operators. I'm not even going to talk about them very much, but the logical operators generate the rotations about the code space. So that means they commute with the stabilizers, but they're not themselves stabilizers. So two logical operators on the toric code are strings of Pauli X's that run vertically and strings of Pauli Z's that run horizontally. You can check, I'm not going to check just now, but you can check that these commute with the stabilizers. But between the two, they anti-commute, and that means you can generate all the rotations about the block sphere with these logical operators in the code space. So the stabilizers are not only a nice way of describing the code and the code space mathematically and abstractly, they're also very practical things because we can measure these Pauli operators, the Hermitian operators, which means we can measure them, and we can measure them to detect errors. So what we know is a stabilizer is supposed to give you the plus one outcome. But say we had a code word that is in the plus one eigenspace of the stabilizers and it experiences an error. When we measure that stabilizer and it doesn't commute with that error, we might get the minus one outcome. And this is information we can use to try and detect when errors have occurred. So if you like the condensed matter picture of things, I was told maybe there'll be some people from condensed matter here. We can actually think of these violated stabilizers as excitations. If we take the sum of the stabilizer operators with a minus sign in front of it, the ground space of this Hamiltonian also happens to be the code space. And we can think of these, I'm going to call them defects. The defects are stabilizers that have given the minus one outcome, but you can think of a defect as being an excitation. And I'm going to talk a lot about the kinds of rules these excitations have to respect. So the errors on the toric code, they actually respect, it's nice to interpret them geometrically. So the errors on the toric code, you can view them like strings. So here are some pictures of some errors, some bit flip errors run along in the line. And the defects appear at the endpoints of these strings. So errors look like strings and defects live at their endpoints. And so what does a decoder have to do? It has to take these defects and it has to try and pull them back together again. We have to assume a few things about the noise model. Like, for example, errors are quite uncommon, so maybe the strings are quite small. So the challenge is really just pulling nearby defects back together again to correct the errors. That's right. So in quantum error correction, the figure of merit that we tend to use to assess a code, we have at least a couple. One of them is the threshold error rate. So to see a threshold, we often talk about, we often look at a graph a bit like this one. So for example, I shouldn't worry too much about what it is exactly, but we have what we tend to plot is the physical error rate of the physical qubits. Typically, we might use an IID noise model or maybe something a bit more sophisticated. And we asked how many times does the decoder successfully recover the right information? That means how many times does it guess well enough what the error is that caused the syndrome? And we call that a logical success rate, or we flip it and call it a logical failure rate every time it doesn't succeed. And what we tend to do is we plot the logical failure rate as a function of physical error rate, and we plot that for codes of varying sizes. So the goal of quantum error correction is that we should be able to make the logical failure rate arbitrarily small by growing the size of the code, provided we're below the threshold error rate. So that's what this graph is showing. Here we have a crossing point. And if the error rate is below that crossing point, then we have codes of increasing size with decreasing logical failure rate. Okay, so now there are two important figures of merit here. First of all, how high is that threshold? A bigger threshold is very good because that means we don't have to work quite so hard to make our qubits really good in the lab. So if we can find codes and decoders with higher thresholds, then they're easier to make and we'll get a quantum computer sooner. Another figure of merit is how fast does the logical failure rate decrease? So this is actually the log of the logical failure rates. I shouldn't worry too much about that. But then the goal is if the logical failure rate falls off really fast with increasing the number of qubits, then you don't need too many qubits to get a quantum computer with a target logical failure rate. So the logical failure rate scaling is another important thing to look at once you're below threshold. I'll talk about both of those things in a little bit. Okay, so as I said, the toric code has some structure to it, namely that the defects show up in pairs, and we have to try and work out what strings created those pairs of defects. And we have a bunch of good algorithms for doing that. One that's been particularly successful is what's called the minimum weight perfect matching algorithm. There are lots of variations that I don't want to talk about too much, but they're all interesting. So what does minimum weight matching, what it does is it takes a graph. What's a matching? A matching is you give me a graph with some edges on it, and then I remove edges until all of the vertices have one and only one edge still touching each vertex. That's actually a perfect matching when it's one and only one. So what does a minimum weight matching mean? Well, you assign all of the edges a weight, a number, and I give you the matching such that the sum of the weights of the remaining edges are minimal. That's a minimum weight perfect matching algorithm. So this is really useful for decoding the toric code because if we say assign all of the defects a vertex that we put into this minimum weight matching graph, and we assign a weight that's maybe proportional to the probability that a string caused a pair of defects, or actually the logarithm of the probability with a minus sign in front of it, then the decoder is very good at predicting a low weight error that probably caused the syndrome, and that works really well. So that decoder is very good, and I want to generalize that. I want to be able to use that decoder on any kind of code. Now, why do we get to do that? Why does the toric code have this structure where the defects always appear in pairs and errors look like strings? So in fact, here's the thing. The toric code has what we call a charge parity conservation law or a defect parity conservation law. So here's the thing about string errors, right? If you have strings, all strings have two endpoints, one, two. That's an even number. And all errors look like strings. So here's the thing. That structure means that you never, ever see an odd number of defects on the lattice. You always see them in even numbers. And this structure means that you can always pull pairs of defects back together again, and that string will fix up the error. So that's a conservation law. Now, that conservation law actually shows up because of the structure in the stabilizer group. Now, let me show you that. And I'm going to call this a symmetry. What this is really a Noether's law for quantum error correction. There's a conservation law. Defects show up in pairs. Those are charges that show up in the Hamiltonian, like I mentioned before. But there's a symmetry that gives rise to that. And that symmetry is, well, you can take the product of all of the stabilizers, say all the star operators, and you get identity. So that you can see that because every single qubit touches two star operators, one to its, well, in this case, left and one to its right. So if I took the product of this star and this star, you get x squared. And if I take the product of all of the stars, then all of the qubits see two vertex operators. So you get x squared on all of the qubits. Right, and that gives you, globally, the product of all the stars gives you identity. That's true. Now, here's another thing about the identity operator. All of its eigenvalues are one. And so that means for all these things to hold, the product of all the eigenvalues of all the stars also has to be one. Now, these are Pauli operators, so they can be plus or minus one eigenvalues. But in order for the product of all of their eigenvalues to be one, you have to have an even number of minus one stabilizers among them. So that's going to give you the conservation law that I'm talking about. The symmetry here is the fact that the product of all the star operators gives me identity. And this gives rise to the conservation law that minus one outcomes among my star operators always show up in twos. So one implies the other, much like the Noether's theorem. And so, yeah, as I said, Dom and I discovered that this was like a missing link, I felt, when I was trying to understand decoding. This was, I said I was going to stop for questions early on. This is a whole idea. I'm going to talk about this idea all the way through the talk. The idea that the stabilizer group has a symmetry in it, the fact that I can multiply groups of stabilizers together to give me identity, and this gives rise to a conservation law, and I use that conservation law to decode. I want everybody to understand this point. If you leave understanding this point, that's awesome. But I'm just going to apply this idea all the way through to a bunch of other examples. So maybe I could stop for questions for a moment.
So,
okay.
I have one question.
Okay. I can't see who's speaking.
Ray Laflamme.
Oh, hi. Sure, go ahead.
You started by, you argued this using the surface code, but is that true for all codes? All stabilizers?
I said right at the beginning that I would like to generalize it to all codes. So far all I have is examples, and my examples are mostly topological codes where I have, well, you know, we've got lots of physical basis to find the conservation laws. But no, actually, I do have good reasons to suspect that I can make this very general. But that's down the road.
Okay, good, thanks.
So I'm going to talk you through some examples and try and argue that it will generalize, but we'll see. Okay, oh, hang on, thanks for your question. Okay, so look, this has been, we generalized this idea a little bit further. So when I arrived at Sydney, David Tuckett and Steve Bartlett and Steve Flamia, they're all excited about bias noise codes. They found some decoding algorithm that worked pretty well. And it works very well in certain cases, but it doesn't generalize very well. And they found that if the noise biases and that you have the right kind of surface code that's prepared in the right basis, that the threshold goes way, way up. That's really great. But what they really needed was they couldn't generalize it to what we call the fault tolerant case, where maybe you try and measure a stabilizer and the measurement outcome wasn't reliable. Maybe your detector was supposed to go click and it didn't go click. So the decoders they were using didn't generalize very well to this situation, or not efficiently anyway. And so we explored this a bit further and we started looking at the symmetries of these types of codes. And then we found other kinds of codes as well. And we came up with, we realized what we call now the XZZX code is very good at dealing with bias noise. And this is because the XZZX code has different symmetries with respect to highly biased noise models. So let me try and explain this in terms of symmetry. So what we'd like to imagine is maybe the qubits that we build our surface code with dephase much more frequently than bit flips occur. So what we did was we took a surface code and we applied a Hadamard to every other qubit to get what we call the XZZX code. So in this particular picture, I've got the qubits on the vertices of a square lattice, and every single face has a stabilizer that goes XZZX. Now, every time a Z error occurs, it makes a string that's oriented along a particular direction. They all travel diagonally across this picture. And this is really advantageous for quantum error correction because this model doesn't have 2D symmetries anymore. Like in the case of the surface code, you have to pair up all the defects over the whole two-dimensional lattice. Now, in this case, we get to pair up defects along one-dimensional lines. We actually get to treat these Z errors much like a repetition code rather than an entire two-dimensional surface code. And what we know about the repetition code is the threshold is 50%. So just for free, if we have infinite bias noise, the threshold is really, really high. Moreover, we can do all this decoding with minimum weight perfect matching. So the minimum weight matching decoder is actually also very good at dealing with the noisy measurement case. So we found really, really high thresholds in the fault tolerant case where the noise is highly biased. So there are some more tricks that go beyond the symmetries in the conservation laws to interpolate back towards a finite bias noise model, but that was all possible as well. So in fact, what we found was the XZZX code even saturates, and our numerics even showed that we sometimes beat the hashing bound for a high bias noise model. So, you know, we have reason to, this isn't an upper bound on what thresholds can be, but, you know, codes tend to, the best thresholds we find tend to be quite close to what the hashing bound is. And we seem to be able to find the hashing bound with the XZZX code and the right kind of decoder for any single qubit Pauli noise model. Okay, so we had to generalize the notion of symmetry.
Sorry, can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
How do you translate that to the repetition code again?
Well, so a Z error always makes a pair of defects in this direction. It makes a string pointing from like northwest to southeast. So let's concentrate on this part of the picture over here. Because the Z errors only make strings that align in this direction, you never have to pair any defects from here to, you know, a parallel line. So I can really decode all of the Z errors through this diagonal line, independently of all of its adjacent diagonal lines. So like I don't just decode once, I decode lots and lots of 1D problems through all the lines.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So we had to generalize the notion of symmetries to get this picture. And we did this in an earlier paper with David Tuckett down here. So I argue what a symmetry was before is you take the product of a bunch of stabilizers and you get identity. And that promises you that you'll always get, for any error, you'll always see an even number of minus one defects. Well, we can generalize this notion of error by saying, well, let's restrict the error model. Let's not assume the error can be any Pauli group. Let's assume, you know, it's just some subgroup of the Pauli group. It doesn't have to commute, but it doesn't matter too much. So for example, in the last case, we said, well, if the errors were only Z errors, well, now you don't need to multiply groups of stabilizers together to give identity. You need to multiply groups of stabilizers together to give stuff that commutes with Z, so Z terms. So in this paper, this earlier paper, we generalized this notion of what a symmetry is by saying, well, if I take the product, by saying if we can find these groups of stabilizers such that the groups of stabilizers multiply together such that altogether they have an even number of defects among them such that they always commute with the errors of the restricted noise model, then we have symmetries again. And that's exactly what we found here. We took the product of stars and plaquettes along a line. And what we found was we got a term that commuted with Pauli Z errors. And so you can see, so here is the idea. This was what we originally, well, what my co-authors originally called the tailored surface code, where they replaced the Pauli Z stabilizers with Pauli Y stabilizers so that all the Z errors gave rise to lots of defects. They anti-commuted with the X stabilizers and the Y stabilizers. So 4 defects all lit up. So this is now what the syndrome looks like. You have these Z terms and they light up all of their corners. So the symmetry now, again, it lives on 1D lines. This Z error lights up defects on all of its corners. So that always makes 2 defects on all of these horizontal lines. Sorry, that's a vertical. 2 defects on all of these Z, the vertical lines, and 2 defects on all the horizontal lines as well. So again, we were able to decode this in one dimension, and that made the threshold go up quite a lot. And we could generalize it to high but finite bias as well. This example wasn't quite as good as the XZZX code in the end, but it kind of led us to the simpler thing finally. So this is, people seem to be excited about XZZX code. So in other work with people at Yale, like Shruti Puri, and in this collaboration with Andrew Damawan and some others from Sydney, like Anna Grimsmore, we simulated the XZZX code using real Kerkak qubits, which are qubits they're trying to make in Yale. So these are bosonic encodings of qubits, and they have what we call bias preserving gates. So not only is the noise on these qubits highly biased using these cat qubits are very good at suppressing bit flip errors, but also when they perform gates like CNUT gates and controlled phase gates, the Pauli Z noise bias is always preserved. So we keep these really high thresholds even in this real physical fault tolerance setting. So that's pretty exciting that people are trying to build these things or thinking about how to build these things. And the numbers we got in this paper are persuasive. We should maybe try and build these kinds of codes with cat qubits. Okay, yeah, and so, you can come up with other kinds of... Oh, hi, Benny.
Hey, so I'm wondering, in this experiment, is the noise biased in their like native setup? I don't know what kind of setup.
Yeah. So these cat qubits, I haven't. Yeah. Okay. I could have put a better picture there. But these cat qubits, I'll tell you how they work. They are, you make a coherent superposition of two different coherent states. Make one in the my hands are face. Okay. You have the plus alpha coherent state and you have the minus alpha coherent state, and you call this one zero and you call this one one. And they're approximately qubits because there's a small tail of overlap. But if you make alpha big enough, then the overlap gets really, really small. Mm-hmm. So now, like, what's a bit flip? If you make alpha quite big, a bit flip would mean taking plus alpha to minus alpha and minus alpha to plus alpha. So that requires a lot of noise or a lot of work to make that jump happen. Uh-huh. But a photon loss is like a Z error, and that gets the probability of a photon loss increases as you grow alpha, not quite as fast as you suppress bit flips, but you can make this alpha quite big, and you get very good bit flip suppression, and you know, reasonable dephasing noise rates with this kind of encoding, and so. And there are ways. It's quite technical. It's not that.
I think I got the essence.
You understand? Okay. Yeah. Well, no. So not only that, it's but nice. We can do like non-diagonal gates, off-diagonal gates that will also preserve the bias by rotating this coherent space around. Uh-huh. So you can do a NOT gate by moving them like this. So because they stay well separated, the probability of a bit flip error is still quite bad, even though still quite good, even though you're doing an off diagonal gate that a priori you would expect would be quite noisy. So yeah, and that's a NOT gate, but a CNOT gate kind of comes out of the same kind of intuition.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll maybe I might skip this one actually. But all this slide says is. That you don't just have to look at Pauli Z bias noise models. What Naomi and I found was that you can find symmetries among correlated noise models as well. We looked at a very like a toy model, a toy correlated noise model, and we were able to decode it. And I didn't know it at the time, but now that I know, the reason we were able to decode it quite well is because the correlated noise model respected a symmetry. So I think there's lots of scope to keep exploring these tricks for decoding with other kinds of noise models. But, you know, there's lots of work to be done, like learning different types of noise that's going to occur. And, you know, really people designing decoders need to talk more and more with people who are doing benchmarking, trying to work out what kinds of correlated errors occur most commonly. And then we should be designing our decoders and our quantum error correction codes around those kinds of things. And I wonder if this language of symmetries, well, I like to think or hope or encourage people to try and use this language of symmetries and conservation laws and decoding to try and come up with the right codes and the right decoders to deal with the noise models that we really see in the lab. That's a little tricky. Okay, so what I really want to talk about, I'm going to maybe concentrate on this example the most because it's quite new work. I got some people who know about color codes in the audience. This is work I did with Kavya Sahai. She was an undergraduate intern at Sydney a couple of years ago and working over pandemic days. And now she's a PhD student at Yale. And what we found was a symmetry for decoding the color code in a better way than what decoders have been able to do. Okay, so what's going to happen is that I'm going to show you a symmetry that shows up on a Mobius strip. I'm building this symmetry. So that's a picture of a Mobius strip and a color code symmetry on top of it. I'm going to show you how we made that Mobius strip and the results we got out of it. Okay, so before I do that, though, let me just talk about how we deal with the boundaries in terms of symmetry, because what everybody asks, and it's a good question, is if I have you told me that the toric code has got this charge conservation law, but if I put the toric code on the planar code version of it, if I make that one, and the boundaries are rough and smooth, which is, you know, a normal way of encoding them, then a single error can make a single defect, and that violates the charge conservation law. And that's sort of true, but it's also sort of not. So let me show you the resolution of this problem, and let me then also show you how this resolution fits inside of my picture of how error correcting codes are structured. And this is going to be important for understanding the color code example as well, because I'll use the same trick, but it'll be a bit more complicated. Now, here we go. Here's the toric code again, but it's got rough and smooth boundaries. Here's a rough boundary. And if I make a string of Z errors that leads off from the rough boundary, I make one defect all by itself. And okay, so that's not respecting the charge conservation law, but we can deal with this problem. Anybody who's done this, this is, you know, master's student 101 training in how to learn error correction in decoders. And the way we fix it is we say, well, look, there's an odd number of defects, so that means something must have gone off to the boundary. So what we do is we say we take another defect, or we make like a virtual defect, you might call it, or a dummy, and we leave it outside of the lattice. And what we do is we let the defects inside the lattice pair out to the dummy vertex that lives outside of the planar code. That's fine. Now, this does live inside the language of symmetries, because in fact, what you're doing when you count how many defects are in the bulk and you ask, was it an odd number or was it an even number? What you actually did was you took the product of all of the star operators. The product of all the star operators will give you plus or minus one, where a minus one means there was an odd number of defects and a plus one means there is an even number of defects. Now that too is an operator. That the product of all the star operators is a boundary operator that I'll call little b. And the product of all the star operators is, well, Pali X on all of the rough boundary over here and Pali X on all the other rough boundary over here. And that value is minus one because this string touches the boundary operator. So actually, by including this extra boundary operator, we recover a symmetry. If I take B, the boundary operator, and I multiply it by all the star terms, I get this identity term, which is what I said at the beginning. That's what I need to be able to come up with a matching decoder. And that's what people have been doing for a long time, but I don't think they've really said it this way. And I like saying it this way because it fits in with what I want to say. Is there anything else to say about that? Actually, this is an interesting point because this is why a big, big generalization of this idea is quite hard, because the trick is People like to talk about the stabilizer group as either an independent generating set, or they like to talk about the entire group altogether. But the tricky thing with symmetries is you need to overcomplete it by just a little bit. And the right way to overcomplete it is not completely obvious. I have some ideas about the right way, but that's a little bit too speculative for this talk. If somebody asks me the right question, maybe I'll say, but let's see. Okay, so I'm going to apply the same trick to the color code. So the color code, this is the color code. Everybody likes the color code because it's good at doing transversal gates and various other ways of doing it. So it's a quantum error correcting code with a qubit on the vertex of, on every single vertex of a three colorable lattice. So three colorable lattice means I can give all the faces one of three colors and no two faces of the same color touch. You can see the hexagonal lattice satisfies this, but anything that's three colorable will do the job. It also has different kinds of boundaries. So here are some qubits on a boundary. These qubits don't see a green face, so I call this the green boundary. These qubits don't see a red face, so I call it the red boundary, and so on and so on. Okay, and what we have, I saw Alex was watching, I hope he's still watching. He's done a lot of work on this, and lots of people have done lots of work making min weight matching decoders for the color code as well. And I'm going to re-express all those decoders in terms of symmetries, because I think that's the way we should be talking about decoders. Now, okay, let's talk about the conservation laws of color codes first of all. Now, if you flip a single qubit of the color code, you make one red, one green, and one blue defect. That's three defects. So that's not the conservation law right there. You can also make strings. I can make pairs of red defects through a longer string of errors, but let's concentrate on the single qubit error, because what happens with the single qubit error is all the parity of all three different colors change together. So what I can say, as long as I stay far away from the boundaries, is the number of red defects is equal to the number of green defects is equal to the number of blue defects modulo 2. Right, and what I want for a conservation law, a charge parity conservation law, is an even number of defects. So let's talk about numbers. Let me tell you something about numbers. If you take a number, an integer number, and you multiply it by 2, you get an even number. So if you take, see people go writing that down. Now, if I take the sum, okay, all these numbers are equal. So if I take two colors out of three and the numbers are equal, I'm going to get an even number. So the symmetries of the color code are those where you take pairs of colors. Or that's the conservation law. So I can also pull out a symmetry from this. If I take the product of all of the green and blue stabilizers, for example, then they have to respect the conservation law as well. This is going to be the symmetry. So here I've taken the product of all the blue and green stabilizers. And what you can see is by ignoring the red, this single qubit error made a pair of defects, and I can pair them up. I ignored the reds, so this made zero defects, but zero is an even number as well. And here I made a pair of greens, and here I made a pair of blues, and these reds were also ignored. So you can see with all those arguments that that's the conservation law are two of the three colors, and the symmetry is the product of two colors of stabilizer and ignoring the last one. And what else is there to say about that? So I think this is related to the fact that the color code is two copies of the surface code as well. And anyway, like underlying all of the different kinds of decoders is more or less this, like you pair up pairs of colors and you get good decoders. And there are some citations down here. But now let's talk about the boundaries again. So here's a problem with the color code with boundaries. I'm going to play the same trick as I did with the surface code. I take the product of all of the plaquettes on a lattice with boundaries, and you get this boundary operator with two sides of the triangle, and one is missing. So I have to include this stabilizer in with my the stabilizers, the face operators of my symmetry in order to be able to pair successfully. And this kind of causes problems when you have a code with a code that lives on a triangle, because so here's the thing with quantum error correcting codes. You want them to be able to correct as many errors as possible. And you should be able to correct d divided by 2 errors, where d is the code distance. So the number of qubits here is about d squared, or 3/4 d squared, actually. And okay, but if there are d on 3 errors, this is actually enough to confuse this decoder, or d on 3 plus a little bit, because, well, you know, everybody just knows from the geometry of a triangle that a string of errors about this long can lead me to the middle. And if I just look at, and I have to make a decision about how to pair these defects in the middle, and I might send it the wrong way, and this can lead you to a logical error if you're not too careful. Okay, but we can deal with that. We can deal with that by looking more carefully at what the boundary operators are. So let me do that. So there are three different boundary operators. Like there are three different conservation laws and three different symmetries by choosing, you know, any two of the three colors of the color code. So let me call them the boundary for the red-blue faces that lives on these two sides, the boundary for the green-blue faces that lives on these two sides, and the red-green boundary that lives on these two sides. And the interesting thing about the color code is that the boundary operators also respect a symmetry. If I take the product of all three of these operators, I also get identity. Maybe you can see that really fast, or maybe you can just trust me. So I want to build all these lattices together. I'm going to put them all together in a way, well, the only way that seems to make sense to me. And what you're going to see is a Mobius strip. Okay, so here we have, here I took this boundary operator and I put it in the middle. And I want to take the product of these qubits and these, I'm going to take the product of these qubits here and these qubits over here. So to make them all line up, I'm going to take this boundary operator, but I'm going to flip it around. So this is actually, I want you to look at my hands. My hand right now is the boundary operator at the top left of my screen. And to get it into the position at the bottom right of my screen, I had to turn it like that. Like unfold it like a book, like that. And I'll do the same with the blue-green one as well. That's going to fold out like that as well. And that means that these qubits here are these qubits here, and they line up with these qubits now. And so I can unify these to make a bigger lattice. So let me do that. All of those qubits will get unified together. And actually this red corner also unifies with this red corner, and I squeeze them all together and I get a lattice a bit like this one, where the red-green lattice is now touching the blue-red lattice, and they're all fused together like this. I'm going to do the same trick one more time. I'm going to fuse this blue-green lattice onto the red-green lattice. And what I'm left with is this picture at the top. But now as a final step, I could have matched up this boundary that came from down here. This boundary is the same as this boundary. And this boundary is also the same as this boundary. So to complete this model, what I want to do is I want to take this edge and fuse it with this edge. But now the way I made it with this book-like unfolding, where this corner number 7 qubit is this qubit over here, number 7. And this is a mirror image. This lattice is a mirror image of this lattice through this line. Well, now this boundary that goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 is also this boundary 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So if I want to join this qubit that goes from 1 to 7 to this boundary that goes from 1 to 7, it goes from 7 to 1, then I have to put a twist in it to bring it back around again. And what you end up with is this Mobius strip-like manifold that you do all your matching on. And how's my time? I've got 15 minutes, so I'm doing pretty well, I think. So this is the Mobius strip. What we found was we took the color code on a triangle, we took all of its symmetries, we looked at the boundary operators of these symmetries, and we plugged them all together. And this is, I don't know what else you could come up with except that. And we decoded on. So this is handy to decode on, because I tried to point out this problem to you before, that an error can come. A weight d on 3 error can come out to the middle of the lattice, and you might pair it in the wrong direction. But now, because of the way I've duplicated this error over the whole Mobius strip, I'm not going to make this mistake, because now, instead of what I was worried about before, was maybe I'd pair this defect to this boundary, but you don't stop at this boundary anymore. You go all the way through to the next restricted lattice. And if you want it to fail, it has to go all the way around the lattice to cause a fail. So this Mobius strip actually allows you to correct much higher distance errors than what we could if we just concentrate on one restricted lattice at a time.
Hi, Ben. I have a question. So with a Mobius strip, you still have a boundary. So so do you could you have a point-like excitation which goes to this Mobius strip boundary as well? Do you need to consider like two cases that it goes or not doesn't go, or...?
We have this boundary. So this is kind of like a confined boundary.
I see. So nothing can go there. Okay, thanks.
No, well, if you make an error there, it makes two defects. Yeah, so it's a hard boundary. Okay, where nothing can escape. Yeah. Did I answer your question? I think.
Yes, you did. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's right. It's a hard boundary. So the whole thing is only got... Yeah. Good kind of boundaries. It's like a cylinder, really. It's a cylinder. Well, except it's a Mobius. I just told you it's a Mobius strip. Okay. Right. So this structure actually allows you to correct higher weight errors. So this is numerics that Cavia actually conducted. So as I said at the beginning, what we're interested in is how does the logical error rate decay with system size? And one way you can model that, I've taken out a lot of the terms in the model, but roughly your logical error rate should scale like the physical error rate to the power of d, the code distance, times some alpha, which is some fraction of the code distance worth of errors that you can tolerate. So if you put, if you calculate the logical failure rate for a bunch of different system sizes and a bunch of different physical error rates, and you put it on a log-log plot, this is log p versus log p fail, you can see in the axes. Well, then these straight lines, the gradient of these lines should be roughly d times alpha. So we plot those gradients over here. And we got a gradient of, this is the gradient of gradients. And if you look at the gradient of this line, it tells you what this number alpha should be. It can't be higher than 1/2. But what I was arguing before is that it could be 1/3 if we didn't use this Mobius strip. So this red line shows 1/3. And we did better than that. But we didn't get quite as high as Dion 2. But we did, just not with this decoder quite yet. We had to improve it a little bit more. But the Mobius strip was important. So this has a gradient of 3/7. And we can explain that. It's not a problem with the boundaries anymore. It's a problem with just with the geometry of the color code, because different types of errors can bias the decoder in bad ways. But we dealt with this in kind of a manual way. What we did was we used this minimum weight matching algorithm more than one time to come up with multiple corrections. And we had to kind of cheat it. So to do that, we ran the minimum weight matching decoder once. And then we broke the Mobius strip. We put a tear in it. And we put some dummy nodes in it to make it find an alternative correction. And rather than just taking the first solution the first minimum weight matching decoder gave us, we found two solutions and we manually compared them. And we found a condition whereby we took the best one. And well, we don't know that it works perfectly well in general for all system sizes, but we tested it exhaustively for all errors of size D on 2 up to distance 13. At this point, by the way, I think there's something like 5 billion error configurations. So it's starting to get quite slow for system sizes bigger than this. This has grown exponentially. And we found that with the condition, with the decoder we found, we could correct D on 2 errors for up to, distance 13. But we know that the conditions won't actually survive after, I think, about distance 27. But you know, this is still pretty good. It should indicate that we can get scaling like Dion 2 errors up to a reasonably good system size. So in the back of this paper as well, there are lots of ways I would like to see this generalized. I think there are some tricks we could use for decoding depolarizing noise with the color codes. I've written a bit about how to generalize it to 3D codes, some ways of doing noisy measurements. The Mobius strip only shows up, by the way, if you decode a color code on a triangle. If you were to maybe do quantum computation with the color codes, you might consider color codes with different boundary configurations. And if you do that, then applying all these tricks again gives you different topologies other than that of a Mobius strip. So this is, I don't know if it's obvious, but this is actually a torus with a disc-shaped puncture in it, which comes out if you take a color code with two blue boundaries and two green boundaries. I think there are lots of ways to generalize this idea, as I said at the beginning, and there are lots of ways to generalize it just with the color code. The color code has lots of structure to play with. And as usual, I haven't really gotten, haven't left quite enough time. Yeah, so as I said, my work with Dominic Williamson kind of led us to see all of these generalizations. Dom and I, Dom showed up and he said, oh, do you think this model, which he calls the X-cube model, would this be a good quantum error correcting code? I said, well, let's see. And it's not such a good error correcting code. But what's interesting about it is it's this 3D topological code called a fracton code. And even though it's a three-dimensional model, the model respects two-dimensional symmetries. So these are the kind of the tricks that we ungeneralize to come up with things like the XZZX code, where a two-dimensional code has one-dimensional symmetries with a restricted noise model. But with this fracton code, you have this 3D code, but the errors, well, the defects that the errors create respect two-dimensional symmetries. So we found a minimum weight matching decoder that was good at decoding these kinds of errors. And why I really want to generalize this, like I would like this whole program to be able to decode general LDPC codes or other kinds of codes, other kinds of fractal codes. So for example, this is something Benny's worked on, I know, he's got papers about this, but for example, Haas cubic code. So here's a model where this is a really nice model because it has high distance, higher than, you know, the toric code can achieve, because its logical operators are fractals. They're not strings like in all the other codes I've been talking about so far. And they have really strange symmetry. So I made some progress with this problem because I found the symmetries, but I haven't quite worked out how to apply the results of matching on these symmetries to find a decoder. So that's partial progress. This is the next thing. And I feel if I can understand everything with this model, maybe I can then go past topological codes and find something else as well. I have, as I said, I have some other ideas that are a bit too speculative for this kind of talk. Okay, but we did make some progress on 2D classical fractal codes. And I think this was kind of neat. So what we found was, we looked at this classical code that we called the Fibonacci. I think Benny called it the Fibonacci code as well, actually. So it's got a bit on every single square face, and it stabilizes, look like this little Tetris brick. And the symmetries of this model aren't these 1D things. They're not these 2D things. They're these fractal shaped things. And okay, but again, this model, the reason I like this model is because it has a lot of common properties with the quantum cubic code of Ha. And so a lot of intuition came out of studying this model. And what we found was this code has a higher distance than, it doesn't have string-like errors. So we should be able to find a decoder that can correct, you know, higher weight errors and string-like errors. And we got numerical results showing we could do this. So these symmetries look like fractals, and, you know, globally, they actually look like triangles. And so what we found was, because we don't match on all of the two-dimensional space at once, we just look at this little fractal space. If there is a big, bad, high weight, one dimensional correlated spanning error, this fractal decoder can come in and match individual errors one by one. And so we were able to show that we could correct errors of weight higher than, on an L by L lattice, weight higher than order L. So we got lots of numerics to show that. We looked at how the logical failure rate scales as a function of system size. And we found that it would scale more than linearly in the linear size of the lattice. It would scale more like L to the 1.4, which is bigger than one. And we also found a threshold by introducing errors that run through. We actually just hit the whole thing with errors that run through the vertical columns and the horizontal rows of the lattice. Like you would probability P, bang, all these errors flipped all at once. And the code and our decoder even had a threshold against that. And yeah, so we found these decoders using the fractal symmetries of this model as well. So I think, yeah, this is a promising route towards other topological codes. I've got a few more topological codes to look at before I can generalize this completely. What I hope I've expressed is that this picture of symmetries gives us a good way to unify the minweight matching decoder. It's unified, you know, lots of other people's work on minweight matching decoders, improved some minweight matching decoders. It's shown us how to find good minweight matching decoders for bias noise models by choosing the right codes and generalizing the notion of symmetries. We've found decoders for fracton codes and fractal codes this way. And I've repeated myself a lot, but I would like to extend this idea further to codes in general. Maybe we can get higher performance decoders using matching for high rate codes. And we've got lots of new good codes appearing, like lots of exciting stuff in the QIP literature in general. And that's the end of my talk. I didn't leave much time for questions, but I got a few already. And yeah, these are my collaborators, and thanks for listening.
Thanks, Ben. Time for questions. I think, yeah, we have time for questions. So if you have questions, please just speak up.
Okay, maybe I have one. Thanks for the nice talk, Ben. So I just had a question about, you kind of presented this as a kind of reducing the decoding problem, general decoding problem, to matching. But could I understand it really as you're kind of reducing it to toric code style decoding? So could you use like union find instead of matching as your kind of like base decoder?
Yeah, definitely. Anything you want, any subroutine that does the job of pairing up defects.
Okay.
It could be, there are some examples. So for example, the XQube models and the fractal code that you get, it has to give you an even number of defects. It could be four or, you know, any multiple or two bigger than two in general. I don't know how well it will perform or how well it will do. Sometimes it's nice to break up the decoding problem into smaller problems this way. Mm-hmm. It's not clear that it'll continue to work well for past topological codes, but what are you competing against?
Great.
Other questions?
I have a question too. Thanks, Ben, for a talk and for a nice talk. With your relations or symmetries, right? You multiply an extensive or sub-extensive number of stabilizer generators. Isn't that fragile when you have some phenomenological noise that you cannot rely on the stabilizer outcomes 100%?
Let me check. Well, yeah, that's true. But I feel this symmetry language can be extended to the phenomenological case. Good question. I have a slide ready. So as Alex said, if you do get a measurement error, you might see something like a violation in the symmetries. It might not even be obvious. Like you could get two measurement errors on a big lattice, and that will look like it's respecting the symmetry again. But well, you know, as physicists, we know if a measurement apparatus isn't perfect, then we repeat the measurement over and over and over again. And this has been the way to deal with this problem since the Dennis paper. In fact, like given any symmetry and, you know, an idealized decoder, you can actually apply this same method to deal with noisy measurements. So what people do, so here's how you deal with noisy measurements. You repeat the stabilizer and you don't care about the absolute value of the stabilizer anymore. What you care about is the parity of two adjacent measurements. Where I mean, when I say adjacent, I mean adjacent in time. So here I measure the same plaquette three times, one at time t minus one, one at time t, and one at time t plus one. And I compare the value of this stabilizer measurement to this stabilizer measurement. Also, by the way, I didn't explain it completely. So this measurement was correct. Here there was a measurement error. No physical errors have shown up, but here we measured it again and it was fine. So maybe we saw plus one, minus one, plus one. So if I take the product of these two outcomes, I'll get a minus one outcome. So I call that a defect now. And then I compare the measurement at time t and the measurement at time t plus one as well, and I see another defect. Okay, so I made two defects from one measurement error. So I can view this as a string as well, and that's that measurement error string is also respecting a conservation law. So this trick of repeating, like comparing two time adjacent measurements, it's kind of forcing a symmetry in this higher dimensional space. So hang on, I was talking to Alex there, but I should have been talking to everybody. So what, you know, in general, what we do is we repeat the measurements over and over and over again. And we do that with all of the stabilizers. And then we look at all of the measurement outcomes in this way that I just described in a big three-dimensional or a 2+1-dimensional space-time, where now physical errors look like horizontal strings in this space and measurement errors look like vertical strings in this space. And we can just run minimum weight matching on this whole space altogether. So you can, yeah. So maybe I'm just trying to pull this picture back into this picture of symmetries, but the way I view this Dennis trick is that they're pushing the conservation law back into the space-time by comparing time-adjacent measurements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. You don't have to repeat it over and over again. You could measure something else, as we know from single-shot error correction. But yeah, thanks.
Sure. Okay. I mean, but this is our way.
Yeah.
Hang on. Let me see. You can kind of view single-shot error. Single-shot error correction also has some interpretation in terms of symmetries as well. Here's a picture of the gauge color code, but when you deal with the measurement errors in single shot error correction, you know, you think of these as defects that respect certain charge conservation laws, and you pair up with respect to those as well. As I said, at the moment I'm dealing with this case by case, so generalizing it is a bit difficult. I'm not even quite at the case of a general measurement error approach to dealing with these things yet, but yeah, you're right that your point is right that you can there could be other ways of decoding things other than the way that I just suggested. Maybe you mute. Did you mute yourself, Alex?
Your silence. I am favorably satisfied. Thanks.
Okay, good.
Any other questions?
So I'm gonna ask another one related to the noise and experiments. So this symmetry that you're talking about in conservation laws is a property of the combination of the noise and the error correcting procedure, or only of the type of codes that you have looked at?
It is a property of, it's a property of the code and the noise. And from that you will extract, my procedure is then to extract a symmetry. And then from that you can derive a decoder. That's the idea.
So if the noise would vary as a function of time, for example, in your XZZ code, XZZX code, mm-hmm. if the probability of getting Z or X error change as time goes, can you still have the symmetry that?
So this symmetry, okay. So in the case of the XZZX model, the symmetries we relied on only hold in the case of infinite bias. So in that sense, the symmetry is only approximate if you have, say, high bias of Z noise and, you know, finite Pauli X error noise, but we can generalize the decode. The symmetries are useful for identifying the extremal points, like infinite bias and no bias. And then there are lots of things in between that I haven't described, which is how to interpolate between them, but we can interpolate smoothly between them. In fact, we found that what this graph shows, I didn't talk about it very carefully. I just said it looks like the hashing bound. But here, so that this triangle is like a convex combination of like infinite bias X noise, infinite bias Z noise, and you can't see the infinite bias Y noise, but it's behind you. And this point in the middle of the triangle is depolarizing noise, where X, Y, and Z are all equally as likely to occur. And we plotted the threshold as a function of, this space. And so what you can see is if you have really high bias, you get very high thresholds. If you have, if you have no knowledge about your noise, if it's completely depolarizing, and then the threshold is worse, then that's as good as you can hope. But we can interpolate between them. You can interpolate between them. And if the noise did change, we can still decode it, but I would expect the threshold to change as well in general. I don't know, what else can you say? But here's another thing this graph tells you. What we should be doing is we should definitely be characterizing the noise that we have. If you know nothing about the noise, if it's depolarizing noise and you haven't done any work to characterize if X or Y or Z are more common or anything, then your threshold is less. If you know a lot about your noise model, then you can design a better code and a better decoder, and maybe thresholds go up, and that's important.
Thanks.
Well, I think we have lots of questions already, so I think it's time to end the seminar. So let's thank Ben again for the great talk. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your attention.